I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jay Miller joins me now, the Toronto-based poet, editor, publisher, teacher, and virtual bookseller, was in Vancouver this past weekend to launch his latest collection of poetry, Timely Irreverence. It's a collection of poems that are stimulating, that look at creativity, and how we view poetry itself. It's at times funny, sometimes it's serious, and it's always thoughtful. I'll get Mr. Miller to tell us about his work, what publishing a collection like this is like, and about poetry today, its relevance, and its future. He has written numerous books, including Small Blue, False Maps for Other Creatures, Mycological Studies, and The Ghost of J. Miller. His previous collections include ESP, Accumulation Sonnets, and Other Poems. He is a coordinating force behind Book Thug, an independent publishing house that publishes the exploratory work of well-known and emerging writers in North America. He also teaches creative writing and poetics at George Brown College and the Toronto New School of Writing. This new book is published by Nightwood Editions. Bookthug.ca is the website for more. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in studio today, J.A. Miller. Mr. Miller, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
So, it's pronounced Miller, right? Or Miller?
It can be pronounced either way, actually. Growing up, it was Miller. But then, in my last year of high school, I actually started going to a different school, and there was another kid in that spelled it with an ER, so he was Miller, and they called me Millar.
Millar.
And then I just started saying it that way.
And then
spell it right.
The capitalized A, I mean, do people still ask you about that?
Yes.
Yeah.
As I imagine you're going to.
I am. Is that annoying?
That people ask me?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's there so people will notice that it's an A.
Yeah, and I guess it's something that if you're checking. You can check for a typographical error or something like that.
Sure.
They'll know that they're actually paying attention to what your name actually is. Is your driver's license, does it have that?
Miller with an A?
Yeah.
Not with the capital, no.
No. It's National Poetry Month, and I read that in the stuff that your publicist sent when they sent your book and Mr. Cran and Ms. Bashinsky's books. What does that mean to a poet? I mean, I always wondered, you know, if you're a poet, what does National Poetry Month mean?
As a poet, I don't really think about it that much. I really like that National Poetry Month is the same month as National Autism Month. I think somehow the two are deeply connected. I don't know. I like that there's a month that's set aside for poetry for people to think about it and to be aware of it more, but for me, it's always like just National Poetry Day.
Does it encourage you the way that poetry is taught in schools? I mean, you have young kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the way that they learn it and the way that you practice it, is there some connection?
I found it really interesting working with young kids. I'll go into schools, or I remember the first time I ran a workshop with a group of Cub Scouts. And what I found really interesting was that the kids were mostly interested in whether their poems were right or wrong. I would run them through some exercises to write some poems, and then they'd run up to me and say, is this good? Is this right? And I was trying to encourage them that that's not necessarily the way to think about it.
Yeah.
It's more about like, well, you know, let's think about it some more.
You know? So there is no right and wrong, right?
I don't think so, especially with, poetry is such a widely, it's a huge field, really.
Yeah.
There's people writing all kinds of different kinds of poetry.
Is there bad poetry in your opinion?
There is bad poetry, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not based on a style.
Whose?
Whose poetry is bad?
Yeah.
I'm not going to say whose poetry is bad. But people in the recent history of Canadian poetics and poetry, there's been some interesting battles that are more or less choosing sides, saying something that is good or bad, based on a style of writing. And I don't think that that's a helpful way to think about it. I think there's good poetry that's experimental. I think there's good poetry that's confessional lyrical. It's a huge spectrum of things. And actually, my favorite poetry is the stuff that comes right up the middle.
Yeah,
there's a kind of attention to innovative thinking or innovative use of language, but then there's also something intensely confessional and personal about it as well.
Where would you put your poetry in the poetry?
Oh,
that I'd
put
you
it in the best. In the best category. Yes, absolutely.
We're sitting in a room with a fellow poet. I mean, can you compare your poetry to that of Brad Cran?
Brad Cran's poetry and mine are equally superior.
Oh, they are. Okay, good. So he can unclinch, I guess. He's sitting behind me here as we're taping this. And I asked him when he was in sitting where you are earlier this week when he came to talk about his book, about whether one can read your book for insight as to who you are.
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of me and some and issues that I deal with as a human being throughout the book. There's a lot of details about family life.
And as a writer, do you use poetry to work out whatever it is you're thinking about, say family life, about work?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on the poem. I've always kind of felt that no poem necessarily has to be the same as the one you just wrote. So it's, you know, I'm kind of following my nose to see what happens. Things interest me, things don't interest me.
I've always wondered when people have collections of essays, or in your case, a collection of poems, how you'd like us to read it. I mean, do you want us to go cover to cover, or can we just pick a poem the way it looks, or its title, and just read from the middle, say? Or?
Oh, that's interesting, because this book was composed based on the idea of the title. Originally, it was a sequence of 100 poems that all had interlinking titles. And the idea for actually composing the book initially came from some students of mine who admitted to me that they will buy a book of poetry and then go to the table of contents, and they would choose the poem to read first that had the most interesting title, mm-hmm. as though the title was a calling card for the poem, yeah. or like an advertisement or something.
Yeah.
And that got me really curious about the relationship between titles and poems, that there's actually like a separation, there's like a synaptic jump between the title and the poem itself. And at the same time that happened, I found an old booklet that had been given to me by a friend when I was, I don't know when it was, I was like a student at the time, and we traded these books where we'd written titles for each other, mm-hmm. and we had to, so I gave him a book with 10 titles in it, he gave me a book with 10 titles in it, and I had to write the poems underneath it. And I got really curious about this sort of occasional poem based on a title. So the titles in the book all came from different places. The initial 10 poems that I wrote in the sequence that I was writing, I stole the titles from poems from on the shelves that I had. And then when I finished that, I started stealing the titles from earlier poems. And I was always picking things that I thought might be an interesting title. But then the poems themselves were not written necessarily following the title. I was working on, like, a, you know, my practice is to usually carry around a notebook and, make notations and things like that towards a poem. And then I would just take that poem and stick it under one of the titles until I was done. But then I had this massive manuscript.
Yeah. So what's represented in this collection? Is this the latest stuff? Is this the I mean, it's obviously the best stuff, right?
It's the stuff that I like the most and that Silas, the editor, liked the most.
Yeah,
I did have a number of readers that went through it and made suggestions and stuff. So this I guess would be the creme de la creme of.
And so, what does it represent in terms of where you are as a poet, as a writer, as a person?
Oh, that's kind of a big question. I mean, I'm always battling with myself. There are always, you know, because I run a press like Book Thug, which is dedicated to exploratory work. Let's call it. I think people often associate me as like an experimental writer, but I also hate stereotypes and I hate being placated into little boxes and things like that. So I'm always kind of challenging myself as to what a poet is or does. And maybe this, you know, I started getting a lot more confessional in this book just for the sake of not being experimental. Or not for the sake of it, but to see what that would do, to see what that would be like.
And are you one of these writers that learns a great deal about oneself because of the poetry that one writes?
Probably not. I don't know. The self is a hard thing to know. As somebody that works with other writers all the time, I think the person who knows the least about their own writing is the writer.
Yeah.
Reading poetry and writing poetry, I think, are two different things.
You're also a publisher. What's it like to publish other writers and to be a writer yourself?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. But that's because that's what I do. I don't know. There aren't a lot of publishers in Canada, I don't think, that are run by poets.
Yeah, no, I can't think of anyone, no.
I like it. I mean, I wanted to surround myself with people that I thought were interesting and that had interesting writing to present to myself. There's always like sort of a guilty pleasure in everything that I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I built with Book Thug. I wanted to build a community in a sense.
And what is the state of the community, the poetry community? You told the Globe and Mail in 2011 that the poetry community is very small and it is so ideologically driven. You end up having all these camps. It was almost like high school, but there was no real dialogue happening.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still the case?
No, I think that that's referring back to the great poetry wars of the late 20th century, early 21st century. It's funny to think of these things in historical terms, but where what I was talking about earlier about people having sort of fights about what's good based on styles, right? So it did create all these camps. You had the experimental poets over on one side sort of surrounding certain ideas about what poetry should be, and then you had, I guess, what would be called the new formalist group on the other side. And really they were arguing for the same thing. Over on one side, they'd say, you know, poetry is about the relationship between form and content. And then the experimental poets would respond and go, no, it's not. It's about the relationship between form and content. And they just had different ways of approaching those relationships, really. But really, they were sort of arguing for the same thing. But I think that since then, there's been a lot of cross-pollinization. There's been a lot of people interested in talking back and forth. I mean, that's what I've tried to build with Book Thug anyway, is somewhere where dialogue can happen between those extremes. And I like to think that the poetry that I write falls in there too.
Is this discussion, this dialogue that's happening, is this something that only involves, say, poets and writers, or I mean, are readers? I mean, one would think in any sort of group, any profession, if you will, that it's the purview of, say, the navel gazers. It's navel gazing, essentially.
In what sense?
That this the discussion of what poetry, what's good poetry, what's bad poetry, which kind of poetry is sort of in vogue or should be produced more often. Is that something that poets themselves, is that something that they're only engaged in talking about, or are readers themselves involved in this sort of?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I guess where I sit, I mostly see the fights that the poets do.
Yeah.
When it does rise to the public sphere, then there is a kind of, it approaches this other thing, right? Like it gets media-sized in a different way, where it does seem like it's an actual fight, or it does seem like that's the dialogue that's really happening. When I think that further down where the poets are, the conversation is a lot more about having a conversation. And the media will turn it into something that's a polarized, like, you know, everybody's over here, or they're over here, and so now we're going to have this soundbite sort of competition between one another. But groups of poets operate a little differently, I think.
What's it like to be read in classrooms?
Oh, that's, I love that. That's awesome. Going into classrooms to read my poetry,
even knowing that your poetry is being studied or assigned to students.
That's always really curious to me because, like I said, I don't really know what my work is about. So when I get information kind of burbling back from places like that, it can be really surprising sometimes what people will pull out of poems that I hadn't even thought of.
You live in Toronto. You're out here for this for the launch of your book and the other two books published by Knightwood.
Mm-hmm.
How what is the poetry scene out here like, and how does it look from where you're from?
In Vancouver?
Yeah,
it seems pretty vibrant to me. I'm trying to think of how I would sum it all up. I don't particularly want to sum it up.
No. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We'll skip it.
I think it's really vibrant. I think there's a lot of interesting things happening over here. For a long time, like before the internet, everyone in Toronto was always curious about what was going on in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
But information didn't seem to trickle back very often. I know a lot of people that I was working with, we were really interested with what was going on at the Kootenay School, for instance. And then sometimes we would... I remember once somebody invited some poets, and then they just didn't show up. And I don't know if it was a slight or not, or I don't know if it was just that they got busy. Like, nobody really knew what the answer was. But once the internet came along and the communication lines just opened, then, you know, like-minded poets easily found one another.
How do you write? Is it pen to paper? Is it on a computer?
I tend to write with notebooks first.
With lines?
Yeah, lines, line notebooks, pen. And then later than that gets moved into the QWERTY world, onto a screen, and then more tinkering.
So it is something that you spend a lot of time with, right, before it's actually done?
Yeah.
What moment is it that you know that it's finished?
I guess when it appears in a book.
Really?
Yeah. Once it's published, I can't do much more.
So you don't do it. When you read this and you look back at some of the poems that you've written, you don't second guess yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think that this particular collection I'm really happy with. I'm happy with the poems. I'm happy with the way that I love the way the book looks. Like the artwork that's in it is actually by Phil Hall. It's quite sweet of him to make the images for the book.
And so how do you work with an artist like this? Does he read the poems?
Yeah, he read the poems, and I said, you know, I was talking with him about the book. He said, well, let me read the book. And he often sends things to me in the mail, like interesting things in envelopes and stuff. And I just thought it would be interesting to see what he would do with the book. I thought it was great that he actually used these old library pockets and then decorated them like the way he did.
That's what I miss about going to school and the sort and seeing the old, you know. And I remember, because I have, as you can see from the books in the room here, it's sort of a political and nonfiction Canadiana, and those books never got signed out in the libraries, whether it's the elementary school or the high school.
Yeah.
And so you would see pockets. Mm-hmm. This is before everything was barcoded. The last time someone read it was like in the early 80s or in the 70s, and it's kind of, you know, to see that. We don't see that anymore.
You don't get to see like what the half-life of information is anymore like that. It's all kind of hidden in data banks.
Yeah. What does reading your poetry out loud, as you will tonight when you're launching this book, what does that add to the process?
Well, I think it puts a voice on the poems, right? Like, poems are, I think of all the genres of writing, poems are, you know, I'm thinking of what Frank O'Hara said when he said that poetry should exist between people and not between the pages of a book. Because if they're stuck between the pages of a book, then they get stuck on a shelf somewhere in a library and nobody takes it out.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody stamps the card.
Yeah.
But if it happens in a social situation with people listening, the people listening to poetry, I find that to be a really intimate and interesting experience.
Yeah, and it does it matter if the crowd's big or if the crowd's small? I mean, you still
get
that.
The crowd needs to be huge. Like,
yeah,
we need to.
But is there still intimacy there? Like, if the crowd's like 300 people?
No, I think so. Yeah, I've done a couple of readings now where there's musicians involved. Like, you'll have a musician play for a while, and then the poet will get up, and it's really interesting to me the difference in listening in those two instances. The musicians, they always have this amazing confidence, and they get to do things with their voice that poets don't get to do, and they've got instruments with them, they've got a guitar that they can like hide behind and stuff, and there's this, I don't know, it's really interesting. And then the poet gets up, and it's just like the silence is almost like overbearing after listening to the music, and then all they've got is their little piece of paper that's kind of rustling, making that rustling sound. Yeah, it's way more intimate, I think, than listening to music.
If one picks up your book and they read a poem, and they have to put it down and really sit and think about what they've just read, have they read the poem wrong, or do they just not get it?
No, not at all. I mean, nobody can crack a poem. Poem isn't meant to be, like, consumed and...
I guess that's where the education system has taught us, that we have to find out what the poet meant, read between the lines in that nonsense, right?
Well, I can't say it's wrong. I mean, we think differently now than we used to. The education system now is all streamlined towards some sort of ultimate goal, which I guess is to get a job and join the economic forces that be, right? But something like poetry is, it kind of falls outside that thing. It's kind of already, I mean, in a way it's ridiculous that anybody still writes poetry. It's kind of had its day in a way. People don't think the same way anymore. They want, I think, I'm not saying this very eloquently, but poetry is about lingering. It's about sustaining thought. It's about, you know, it's not about finding the answer. It's not, it's like, you know, if you go to school now, I see this with my kids, right? Like, they go to school and they have to get all the answers right and get the grades, and the grades are really important, right? Like, poetry isn't about grades, right? So it's sort of like this thinking that's different than what normal thinking. I'm not saying this well at all.
No, I think I get it.
Yeah. You know, like, it's a kind of thinking that isn't done anymore. Like, even when people go to university now, the ultimate goal for going to university is to get a degree.
Yeah.
And it's funny now because we have, like, MFA programs and stuff, and people will go and take an MFA program in creative writing so that they can then teach creative writing. And it's kind of this vicious weirdness. Like, that's how strange the academy is, really. But, you know, poetry, I guess, in its purest sense, is more about lingering. It's about, like, not turning pages. It's about not closing. It's about continuing to open conversation and dialogues and thought, like, just suspended thought, in a way.
The publisher hat that you wear as head of Book Thug, you said you enjoy that part of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would assume that there's a lot of paperwork in the sort. Is there?
Yes, there is.
Yeah. Do you enjoy that part of it, too?
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. And how much of your own work is published through there?
Not much. I did publish one book, the book ESP.
Yeah.
I published that, but it was... I don't know why. That was a really sort of intimate text for me. I felt like it belonged... It needed to be vanitized in some way, I guess. I don't know. I also kind of felt like it fell outside of the kind of poetry that other publishers might be interested in.
What's it like to work with Nightwood and Silas White?
Oh, it was fantastic. Silas always has really interesting ideas with not only the poems, but how to order them, how to sequence them, Yeah, and you know what? It was one of the joys for me was to actually take the publisher hat off and to be an author for a while. Not very often do I get to do that, just because of the nature of my daily existence. So it was nice to actually say, "Hey, Silas, you guys make the book. You guys make the decision about what it's supposed to look like, and I'm happy that you guys are doing that."
How many books does Book Thug publish a year or a season?
We do 8 trade books a season and a couple of chapbooks and ephemeral things.
Yeah. And we hear of book publishers going out of business and the sort in this country.
Yeah.
Is it still a profitable venture for you?
How's that for an answer?
All right, we'll take that then. But it's fun, though, right?
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's not something that somebody gets into to get rich, to be a poetry publisher, but it's rewarding to me in many other ways. Book Thug is actually a family business. My wife and I run it. The kids help out. They like to make little... they like to come to the launches and help out with that. My older son will sometimes go to a small press book fair and work the table for us. My youngest son likes to make trailers, like funny little videos about the books. So he finds these animation things online and he creates these things. They're right into it.
Yeah. How old are they?
My oldest is 14 and my youngest is 10.
Do they write too?
They do, but different things. My youngest son is really into this series of books called Skeleton Creek, which is this new, seems new to me, but maybe other publishers have been doing it, where you read a chapter and then you watch a video, and then you read a chapter and you watch a video, and there's all this film footage that involves, and it's all what it is totally Blair Witch, right? Yeah. Like it's a ghost story. It's total homage to, like, he asked me to buy him the complete short stories of Edgar Allan Poe so that he could check that out, because that's what was influencing these books. He likes to, and he writes books like that, and he likes to make the videos that go with it, right? My older son, he likes to, he's a songwriter. He's in a band called The Hunch, and a 14-year-old boy band playing rock and roll. So he likes to write lyrics.
Is there a reader in mind when you're writing your poetry? I mean, is there someone that you'd like? I mean, I don't know, is it presumptuous to say that I'd like that person to read it, maybe?
Yeah, I think when I'm writing a particular poem, there's usually somebody in particular that I'm thinking of when I'm writing it. I'd have to agree with Raymond Souster when he said that if a poet has 26 real readers, actual readers who are invested in thinking and discussing a poet's work, then they have found fame and glory. I don't even think that I have that many, but there are a handful of people that I am writing these poems to.
Yes. And then what's it like to hear from them, or do you?
Yeah, I hear from them. We share work. They're fellow writers, really.
Yeah.
Fellow writers and my wife. And she's not a writer, but she gets to read things.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations on this book. I appreciate you coming in to do this.
Thanks. It's been a blast.
The website, bookthug.ca. The book is called Timely Irreverence. It's a collection of poems published by Knightwood Editions. Jay Miller joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.